wrong. I'm reminded that a few years ago I read that there was a study that was done about the value of live music, and it was something like if you listen to live music once a week, it extends your life by I don't know how many years and more joy to that life as it's going along. And, you know, when we gather to worship, what does the Lord talk about? We are to sing songs of praise unto him. It's almost like the Lord knew this was good for us. So the singing along, and especially when we're doing it in praise of the Lord, is just something that brings real life to our hearts. And so thank you so much for leading us in that. I think that is one of the huge, really refreshing parts of a week like this, and we are so, so grateful. Well, this evening we're going to be talking about desizing the church. As I mentioned yesterday, I came to this book because for over 10 years, Shelley and I have been providing encouragement and resources for small church pastors, and we'd spent so much time with them in tears over their feelings of inferiority and being ignored and so on, and feeling like this was balm to their soul. And for so many ways, so many times, as I said, we felt like we were pulling bodies out of the river. So I thought, this obsession with size, like anything else, doesn't come from nowhere. Everything comes from somewhere. Everything has a cause, except for God himself, of course. So this had to have come from somewhere. It's not a natural thing that we're constantly obsessed with size. So I wonder where it came from. And so a couple years ago, I started doing the research, and it's led me down this fascinating trail that's led to this book, Desizing the Church. Just as a quick note, just because we're really excited about this, just over the last few weeks, we've had some really exciting news about the book. Just before the end of the year, Desizing the Church was given the Award of Merit in Christian Living and Spiritual Formation by Christianity Today Book Awards. So we were thrilled to receive that. And then just exactly a week ago from today, Outreach Magazine named it as one of their top 2025 resources of the year. So something we never expected, but we're really so blessed to be able to receive. And it gives us an idea that there are folks who are paying attention to this and taking it seriously, which is really nice, because it's nice to write something that is taken seriously rather than dismissed. Because a lot of what we talk about in the book is a challenge to some folks, and it's nice to see that there's some serious conversation about these topics. As I mentioned earlier, all of the notes are here at this page, so you can check that out if you would like. Before I get into the talk, though, let me preface it a little bit with this. On February the 1st, 2019, I put this verse on Twitter, or on what was then called Twitter anyway. Don't have anything to do with foolish and stupid arguments, because you know they produce quarrels, 2 Timothy 2:23. I've been reading it through in my devotional reading, and so I thought, where would that verse maybe do the most good? And I thought, I know, Twitter. So I put it up on Twitter without a comment, and it got so many responses and so many retweets and so many, really, on Twitter, that kind of a thing. So I thought, I'll put it up tomorrow and see what happens. Same thing, next day, same thing. So I thought, you know what? I'm going to put that up every day until I fix Twitter. I'm about 2 weeks away. I figure it'll be job done. No, maybe not. So as of today, I have now put that verse on what is now called X, 2,208 days and counting, with no comments from me, but tons of comments and tons of responses constantly from so many other people. In fact, we did it so much that I've had people come to me and go, can you put that like on a mug or something so I can have it in my morning coffee to remind me? Because I really, it's amazing. I get comments regularly like, I was going to engage in an argument on Facebook, and then I remembered that I just liked this post on X, and so I thought, I need to do what I just said I liked and not engage. So I'm just cleaning up my little corner of the internet as much as I possibly can. So they ask, is there done a mug or something? And we thought, well, we don't have mugs or whatever, but we did create a sticker. My daughter went out and she created a sticker, and we have sold so many of them. I've had pastors buy one for every member of their church. Don't want to know what's going on in those churches. But I think we can all guess. So if you are interested in taking that home, we've got them for sale back on the book table as well. I'm telling you this simply because while I'm going to be spending some time taking a critical look from the inside at the evangelical church and the church growth movement, I have no desire to do so out of a heart of confrontation. That's not who I am. That's not what I do. But when there's a big old elephant in the room, I do think somebody needs to point it out. And so that's where I'm coming at it. So I'm not wanting to engage in a foolish or stupid argument. Some people have asked me, how do you know if it's a foolish or stupid argument? Well, look at the end of the verse. If it produces a quarrel, it's a foolish or stupid argument. And how many times have you engaged in an argument online and actually helped anybody and changed any minds? Ever? Which means every argument online is foolish and stupid. Because all it's going to do is produce a quarrel. You know it going in. You're just doing it to make yourself feel better. Not because it's going to move the ball forward. So anyway, I could preach on that one for a while, but I won't. All right. So let's take a look at this desizing the church and what is it all about. What we're going to do in this session is I'm going to ask and try to answer five important questions. What is desizing? Why do we need to desize? Where did our obsession with bigness come from? What are the dangers of pursuing bigness? And how do we fix this? So that's what we'll be looking at in this session this evening. So let's start with the first question. What is desizing? Well, first of all, desizing is a word that I made up. It's pretty cool when you write a book and you put a word on the title, all of a sudden, I guess it becomes a word because it's on the cover of a book now. And when you write, when you make up a word, you get to define it. So here's how I define it. Two different ways. First of all, it's the process of assessing the value of something without obsessing over numbers. And secondly, in the church, it's choosing to evaluate the health and vitality of a congregation, a denomination, or a movement without using attendance figures, percentages, or numerical comparisons as the primary consideration. The two key words in those two definitions are obsessing and primary. Numbers matter. It's important to keep track of numbers. Some of you are way more numbers people than I am, and we are grateful to have you in the body of Christ. We need people who keep track of things like that for us. We absolutely do. But we have gotten to a place of obsession with numbers that I believe is dangerous, and it has become, in many cases, not just the primary, but the exclusive way that we judge whether or not a church is successful or healthy. So desizing is not downsizing. I don't think churches should get smaller. As I said earlier, I don't think churches should be small. I think small churches should be great. And it's not even right-sizing because I don't think there's any right size, but it is dealing with numbers in the appropriate way rather than obsessing over them as we have become used to. It's okay to count what counts, but our obsession with numbers is the primary and sometimes exclusive means by which we judge the value of a congregation or a minister is a real problem. Note the seven churches in Revelation 2 and 3. Jesus criticized the largest, wealthiest, and most prominent churches, and he comforted the smallest and persecuted ones. Throughout the New Testament, that's the model. And we've got to be aware of that. That doesn't mean big is bad, or we've talked about that already. But we need to be aware that this idea that bigger is better simply doesn't come from Scripture. There's no way you can take an honest reading of the Bible, get to the end of it, close the last page, and sit there and go, oh, it's about getting more people in the building. That's what Jesus was all about. We read that into Scripture, but you can't take it from Scripture. So we need to take a look at where did this come from, especially in the body of Christ, since it doesn't come naturally from Scripture. All right, so that's what is desizing. Secondly, why do we need to desize? Numbers define us. They shouldn't, but they do. Let's admit, I'm going to say with a microphone what we all know. A pastor of a church of 3,000 is given more credibility than a pastor of a church of 300. And is given way more credibility than a pastor of a church of 30. It shouldn't be, but nobody argues that it is that way. That's where we are. Numbers have defined us, but I want you to know you're not your numbers and neither are the church you serve. And I say that to my big church friends as well as my small church friends. Big church pastor, you are not your numbers, neither is the church you serve. Small church friend, you are not your numbers and neither is the church you serve. There's something else going on that we need to be careful about. But we've become obsessed with bigness at almost all costs, and it has cost us a lot. This obsession with size is not uniquely American, but it is particularly American. And I learned that in my research, which I'll go over with you in a little bit. And it's really killing us. Let me give you a quote, the only quote I'm going to give you directly from the book. Our obsession, not just with numbers, but with big numbers, may be the major but least acknowledged contributing factor in pastoral burnout, church scandals, divisiveness, misallocation of resources, and many other church dysfunctions. Now, I'm not saying that our obsession with size is the main cause. I'm saying it is the biggest unacknowledged cause. If we could reduce the burden of, I've got to get bigger by this time next year, off the shoulders of every pastor, I believe I would increase the spiritual and emotional health of every pastor in every church in the world. And as we've already talked about, that doesn't mean settling for less. That doesn't mean just staying where you are. But the obsession with, I've got to get bigger, is a greater burden than it is a drive for well over 90% of pastors. This obsession with bigness is hurting us. Numerical success and provides cover for a host of other problems. Let me give you just one quick example. After I wrote the book, Matt Redman, who wrote so many of the newer songs that a lot of us sing, Matt Redman has put out a video on YouTube called Let There Be Light. It's only about half hour long. And Matt Redman put it out because when he was becoming an internationally known singer and songwriter and worship leader in the 1990s, the man who oversaw the ministry that was bringing him around was emotionally and sexually abusing Matt Redman. Redman says that he has since then brought that to his seniors to try to get them to deal with it, and nobody's dealing with it. So he thought, I need to put this out. People need to know how dangerous this is. People need to know what I've gone through, what others have gone through at the hands of this particular church leader. And so he put out this half-hour video called Let There Be Light on YouTube. And I was watching it with real sadness, and I started noticing a pattern. And at minimum 6 or 7 times directly, plus several times implied, they would ask somebody, or the question would be in the air, how did this guy get away with it so long? Why didn't somebody call him on it before now? And 6 or 7 times directly, the answer was some version of, well, we knew there was a problem, but look at the success. Yeah, we knew he was kind of creepy here, but look at all the kids coming to the Lord. His success provided cover for his sin. And you know he ain't the only one. How often do we go, I know things seem kind of weird. Their theology's a little wonky, but look at their growth. The Lord must be blessing. We see it over and over and over again, and we've got to be, this is a problem that has to be addressed, and it has to be fixed. So where did this obsession with bigness come from? Because things don't come from nowhere. Let me give you a quick illustration, and go with me on it, because at first you're going to wonder, where is he going with this? Back when I was a young man, before I went to Bible college, I spent my first 2 years of college in the local junior college to get my general ed out of the way. One of the first classes was Economics 101. We came into the class, and the teacher got up and put one of those old slides on the overhead projector. Remember those? And on that slide was a whole bunch of words like this. Art, community, love, loyalty, kindness, faith. And it was just maybe 100 of these words. And he said, I want you to read these words, and I want you to remember that these things are the things that matter in life. These are the most important things in your life. And I'm looking at it and going, okay, I agree, but did I wander into the ethics class instead of the Econ 101 class? And he said, no, this is Economics 101. He said, I want you to know that these are the most important things in life, because for the next 13 weeks, we're not going to talk about these things. Instead of talking about these things, for the next 13 weeks, we're going to talk about this like it's the most important thing in life. And he put up a slide with one word on it, money. He said, for the next 13 weeks, we're going to talk about money. How to make it, how to invest it, how it affects geo-global politics. We're going to talk about money like it's the only thing that matters, but remember, it's not. And that's what he did for the next 13 weeks. Last day of class, he collects our finals, and he says, before you leave, I want to remind you again of what we talked about earlier. He put the slide back up, and he said, I want you to remember we've been talking about money like it's the only thing that matters, but in fact, these are the most important things that matter. Have a great Christmas break. We'll see you next semester. And we left. But I noticed something had shifted in the room from week one to week 13. On week one, when he put that slide up, everybody was like, yep, that's what matters. On week 13, when he put that slide up, there was a shift in the body language and in the room. And there was a little more cynicism and a little more skepticism. Why? Because they were like, yeah, okay, that matters, but now I know how to make bank. And what had happened was it had actually shifted to more like this. Yeah, we acknowledge that stuff kind of in the background, but we're going to go out and make some cash now. In 13 weeks, he had begun to rewire some of our value systems unintentionally. He talked about money as if it was the only thing that mattered. And for some of us, it started to actually feel like it was the only thing that mattered. So why am I telling you this? For 40 years, I've gone to church growth conferences, and we've assumed that everybody in the room understands that this is what matters in your church. Worship, church health, fellowship, Bible. These are the things that matter. But most of the church growth conferences, maybe they'll pay lip service to that, but sometimes they won't even pay lip service to it. They're just going to assume that everybody in the room understands that's what's important. And while this is what's important in your church, for this conference, we're going to talk about this. And for conference after conference after conference, for 40 years, I have heard talk about church growth as if it's the only thing that matters. This is a problem. Because if in 13 weeks, that college professor began to rewire our value systems unintentionally, what has 40 years of this done? I think it looks something like this now. We say this, but we actually kind of live it like this. In fact, I know it because I've heard things like, I've heard lessons on how worship is a church growth strategy. How to use fellowship to grow your church. Worship isn't a strategy. Worship isn't a means to an end. Worship is the end. Worship is the point. If it happens to put more people in front of me on a Sunday morning, then I'll adapt to that and be grateful for it. But that we worshiped Jesus is the point. It's not a means to another end. But that's what we've done. We've inversed this, and it's not healthy. It's not helpful. So again, where did this come from? Why have we spent 40 years doing this? So I thought, well, I'm going to go back and I want to do a deep dive into the history of the church growth movement. And what I discovered, in fact, was that there wasn't one church growth movement, there were two. The first church growth movement is what I call the McGavran stream. If you're going to do a study of church growth, you have to know about the life of Donald McGavran. Donald McGavran was a missionary from India, missionary to India, from 1923 to 1954. Near the end of his time in India, he started hearing about some of the Indian villages where everybody in the village had come to Christ. And he thought, that can't be. But he was a detail guy, so he went out and he checked on it to see if it was true or not. And lo and behold, he found out it is true. There are entire villages where everybody's come to Christ and they're all being discipled and they all have an understanding of what it means to be a believer. And so he thought, God is doing something here, and I want to see what God is doing. So he started to study this and write down what he was discovering to see if we can learn something about what God is doing that we can maybe apply elsewhere. He then retired from missions work, and on his way home to America, he spent a couple months in Africa, a couple different African nations where similar things were happening in villages there, and he did the same thing. He went to those villages, he talked to the people, he wrote down his findings. He then came back home to the U.S., and in the early 1960s, late 50s, or actually, he wrote his first book called The Bridges of God. And The Bridges of God is universally understood to be the first church growth book ever. In fact, it's the first place where the term church growth ever appears in print. And in it, he gave his results of what's happening when people movements come to Christ. What is God showing us here? And then in 1965, at his 68 years of age, he started the Church Growth Institute at Fuller Institute in Pasadena. I just had dinner with a Fuller graduate today. Yep. And he started teaching that class in 1965 at 68 years of age. And for the first 7 years of his class, he would not allow American pastors to attend. True. Now, you can't just say no American pastors. You get in trouble for that. So what he did was he had three requirements that would filter most of us out. He said you have to have a mastery of at least two languages. You have to have spent at least 2 years on a foreign mission field. And you have to actually write a paper that shows that you have an understanding of an indigenous people group outside of your own, which excludes 99.9% of American pastors, including me, on all 3 points, right? So what he ended up was with foreign pastors and with foreign missionaries, and he taught this class for 7 years. But during that 7 years, American pastors kept going, we want in the class, because they were reading his book, and they wanted in the class. And so finally, in 1972, at 75 years of age, he finally gave in to the overwhelming request, and he taught a class along with one of his early students named C. Peter Wagner. And this is the spark point for the entire American church growth movement. There were only about 20 or so pastors who attended it, but it is universally understood this is where the church growth movement began in 1972 at Fuller. So I read this and I thought, why didn't he want American pastors in the class? So I thought, I'm going to ask his biographer. So I got online and I emailed Gary McIntosh, who wrote the biography of Donald McGavran. And I said, can I talk to you about this? And he said, sure. I said, can I talk to you about it on my podcast? And he went, okay. So I talked to him about this and I asked him, why did he not want American pastors to be in his church growth class? And the really shortened version of the answer is simply this. He said, he knew that outside the U.S., they would read it for what it was, which was, how do we increase the percentage of Christians within a population? But he suspected and he worried that if Americans got a hold of it, we would individualize it and we would turn it into what I call a big church contest. And he wasn't about big churches. He was about what's the best way to reach as many people in this community for Christ. If it's one big church, let's do that. If it's a whole bunch of healthy small churches, let's do that. Let's figure out the best way to bring people to Jesus and do that. He was not concerned with big churches, but he knew that we were obsessed with it. So when he finally did relent and he finally did open the door and he finally let us in, what did we do with what he taught? Exactly what he feared. We individualized it about how do I make my church get bigger. That was never his original intent. Why? Why did we do that? Because of the second stream that I'm going to just call the American stream. Press, freedom of religion, freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, America's greatest and best ideas. But this amendment and, you know, all those documents were written by people mostly who had come from Northern Europe. And in Northern Europe, part of the reason they had left was because of spiritual persecution, religious persecution. If you were not worshiping in the state-sanctioned church, you could be persecuted, so they left. But they came from a place where there was a state-sanctioned church. And when you've got a state-sanctioned church in the Northern European states primarily, when the state sanctions a church, not only do you have to attend the church that the state sanctions, but because the state is running the church, when they collect taxes from the people, they also collect tithes from the people. So in these nations, there was literally a 100% tithing base. So they collected tithes along with taxes. And when they did, they then distributed those tithes to the pastors of the state-sanctioned churches for their salaries and for the upkeep of their facilities. So if you were pastoring in a state-sanctioned church in Northern Europe, you didn't have to worry about how many people were in the room. You didn't have to worry about how big the offering was. You didn't have to worry about any of that. You just got your government check and it paid for everything. So we come to America and we go, not a good idea. We don't want to do that anymore. We want anybody to be able to worship or not worship as they see fit. You can build any church you want. You can say anything you want. You can believe anything you want. Great idea, right? But here's the deal. If the state ain't sponsoring it, the state ain't paying for it. So all of a sudden, they got to go, okay, where are we going to get the money to do this? And what they discovered was the pastor who attracted the biggest crowd, got the biggest offering, could build the biggest building, and could be seen as the biggest success. And that's where it began, as an unintended negative consequence of America's best ideas. Donald McGavran knew this, and he knew that this stream, this Mississippi, had preceded him and was way bigger than the little trickle of a stream that he was trying to bring in. And so what happened was, if you talk to a whole lot of people about church growth, and including some of our megachurch friends who are really into the church growth movement, they will often credit Donald McGavran and his teachings, and they will often use his language. But in fact, most of them aren't doing what he intended to be done. They used his language, but they kept doing it in the American way. And this is kind of where we find ourselves and why it's a particularly American obsession. So, in the book, I also go into other things, including the danger of our celebrity culture and why the Christian celebrity culture guarantees moral failure. And I go into the rise of the suburbs. I never thought I would write a chapter, an entire chapter, about the rise of the American suburbs, but I did, because it's such an important understanding of how we became, got to the megachurch obsession that we have today. The suburbs are a big part of it, so that's all in the book, but we won't deal with that tonight. Instead, let's take a look at question number four. What are the dangers of pursuing bigness? And I do a lot of answers to this in the book, but I'm just going to address two of them this evening. We're going to take a look at these two issues. One of them is it creates an overconfidence in our own abilities. And secondly, it creates an oversimplification of our goals. So let's take a look at these one at a time. First of all, an overconfidence in our own abilities. There's a phenomenon called the Dunning-Kruger effect that I discovered a few years ago, and it's absolutely fascinating to me. The Dunning-Kruger effect describes how people typically learn a complicated process or a complicated life experience, a skill set, a complicated skill set. And so here's how the graph goes. On the bottom left, from the bottom to the top, on the bottom you have no confidence, and on the top you have a ridiculous amount of confidence. On the left, you have no knowledge or experience, and on the right, you have a lot of knowledge and experience. And the line here shows you the way that learning usually goes. We usually start bottom left. We don't know anything about a particular subject, and therefore, we have no confidence whatsoever in our ability in that subject. And then we watch a YouTube video. And instantly, our confidence soars. We go, oh, I got it figured out now. Almost no experience, almost no knowledge, but baby, I got it figured out. Anybody who pastored during COVID knows that you had a whole bunch of people talking to you who were right here. I watched a video, so now I know more than the doctors. I watched a video, so now I know more than the pastors. Right? Some people call this Mount Stupid. I wouldn't do that. But if you want to, you can stay here at the point of overconfidence and just decide, I just got it all figured out, and anybody else who thinks they know more is just, you know, ignorant or stupid or whatever. But if you actually continue to gain in knowledge and actually continue to have some experience in a complicated skill set, after a little while, you end up dropping down to what I call the valley of underconfidence. Okay, the peak of overconfidence is year one after seminary. Hey, I got it all figured out because I went to school. We're going to do a new church. It's going to be different. Everything's going to be changed. It's going to be awesome. And for the first year or so, you are pumped. And at about year four or five, you start looking around and going, man, this is harder than I thought. And you drop down to the valley of underconfidence. I'm convinced that this is where most young pastors quit when they shouldn't quit. But here's the thing. The more confident you are when you begin, the deeper you're going to drop into underconfidence when things get complicated. I know this happens at about year four. I have several examples. Let me just show you one. Just recently, on a small church pastor Facebook page, somebody put this up. I've just hit my fourth year of pastoring. I'm really considering resigning. I'm not certain if I've even been called to be a lead pastor. It's a struggle. My heart is broken. This is played out over and over and over again at about year four, five, six or so. And for most of these people, I'm convinced it's not that they're not called. It's just that it got more difficult than they expected it would. They're in the valley of underconfidence. And here's the good news. If you continue to hang in there, if you continue to gain actual knowledge and real world experience, you will then begin to go up this wonderful place that I call the slope of experience. And as you start moving up the slope of experience, something really amazing happens. Your experience and your confidence increase at the same rate. And this is sustainable. Now your confidence has a basis for it until you get to a place that I call the plateau of stability. And on the plateau of stability, you can continue to move to the right. I should have put an arrow on that line. You can continue to gain knowledge and experience until you go to be with Jesus, but you will never be more confident than you are at this point. I can claim with absolute certainty right now that I am at that point in my life and ministry. I am at the plateau of stability, sustainability. It's not that I can't learn anymore. I can keep learning, but I'm never going to be as arrogant as I was back in the day, because of something that I call the gap of humility. When you gain actual real-world knowledge and experience in something, you start becoming a little more humble about it than you used to be. But here's the deal. If you are a pastor with experience and you're going through some difficult, challenging times, and you know there's complexity to it and there aren't as many easy answers as some people want to believe, there's always going to be somebody standing at the peak of overconfidence who thinks you're an idiot. Right, we've all had that experience in the ministry. And once you know this, maybe it can help you to go, okay, here's what's happening. Now, what does this have to do with the church growth movement? I'm convinced that for starting in the 70s and then it really hit in the 80s, 90s, and O's, for 30, 40 years, we have been at the peak of overconfidence because we've been learning some really cool new stuff about church growth that we didn't know before. And so we have all these pastoral conferences to teach everybody all this cool new stuff. And it's going so great and it's awesome. And let me give you a very visual illustration of what this actually looks like in real life. For a whole lot of years, there were a whole lot of pastors whose bookshelves looked like this. These were the books that we had on our bookshelves, right? Some of you recognize these, right? Your Church Can Grow, Breaking Church Growth Barriers, The Purpose-Driven Church, Simple Church, User-Friendly Church. Your Church Has Real Possibilities, Natural Church Development. I read and learned from all of those books. But that is one confident set of books, isn't it? That is an optimistic set of books. Because they're on the peak of optimism right there, right there. Oh, we got this thing figured. We finally got this figured out. This is awesome. And in the 80s and 90s and into the early O's, it looked like it was working, because do you realize that the 80s, 90s, and O's were actually, in all of the records we've got, the highest church attendance and highest church membership was in the 80s and 90s. We've got this picture that America was always godly and it's been on this downward progression, and it isn't. It's all up and down, including, and I put this in the book, in 1776, we had 17% church attendance. Not 70, not 70, 17. So we're not nearly down to that level yet. It's dropped below 50%. One survey said, for the first time ever, church attendance and membership has dropped below 50%. No, for the first time since they've been keeping records for 80 years. Not for the first time ever. 17% in 1776. So let's relax a little bit, folks. Okay. Knowledge is really helpful because we can go, oh, okay, it's not as bad as we thought. But this happened for a while. So peak of overconfidence, that's where we all were. Then nobody writes any books in the valley of underconfidence. You just eat too much ice cream. All right. But now as we begin to come up the slope of experience, here are some of the books that are now being read. Not only are those books not being read anymore, but those kinds of books are typically not being read by pastors anymore. Here are the books that are currently being read. The Great Evangelical Recession. Losing My Religion, or Losing Our Religion, Unchristian, Autopsy of a Deceased Church, The Great De-Churching, The Rise of the Nuns. When pastors are reading books now, those are the books they're reading. They've gone from super optimism, not to pessimism, but I think to realism. Oh, I didn't put that up. There we go. There are the books. Sorry. These are the books. This is what the current pastor's bookshelf typically looks like, and I'm going to go ahead and throw my book in there because that's the type of book it is too. It's about, let's take a serious look at some of the real problems we have, where they came from, why we have them, and let's talk about some way to continue to gain an experience and start going up the slope where we never go back to that place where we're just so confident we got it all figured out ever again, because we know now that we don't. Does anybody think that the American church is currently anymore on the peak of overconfidence? No. We are now, obviously, at the valley of underconfidence. But the good news is, if we hang in there, if we keep learning, if we stay humble, if we invite Jesus in to help us, and if we gain more experience, we can start going up the slope of experience in the American church. We can start learning from some of our overconfidence. We can start learning out of this time now where the sky is falling. It's not falling. Jesus knows what he's doing. Relax. But as we continue to go, we can continue to move forward. And I'm convinced that's where we are in the American church right now. So that's the first challenge that we've got to realize. We had an overconfidence in our own abilities for a whole lot of years, and we've got to get past that. The second problem is that it leads to an oversimplification of our goals. For 40 years, this is how virtually every church leadership conference looked at church size and health. It was a linear view, a one-dimensional continuum, with small and therefore presumed unhealthy churches on one end, and big and therefore presumed healthy churches on the other end. We know this because how many times have we gone to a church conference where the first line of the bio of the person who's speaking is they took a church from 30 to 3,000 in 3 years? Little, if any, mention of health. And it's all about the numbers. Some of that is because numbers are just easier to put in a little blurb on a thing. I get that. But what we've done is when we see a church get bigger, what is our approach to it? How did they do that? Let's learn from it. When we see a church that's small, we go, what's their problem and how can they fix it? We start with a presumption that the small church is broken and needs to be fixed. We start with the presumption that the big church is healthy and needs to be followed. And all we need to do is take a look at the news that's been coming down the last couple of years of so many high-profile ministers and pastors in large churches to realize there are some big churches that aren't that healthy. And although they don't make the headlines, there's 10 times as many small churches that aren't healthy either, because there are 10 times more small churches than big churches. So it's not a big small problem. It's our size obsession problem. So here's my suggestion. Instead of looking at it in a one-dimensional continuum, how about we break it out into just two dimensions and put it something like this? So when you go from the bottom to the top now, you go from smaller to bigger, but you've also got from the left to the right going from unhealthy to healthy, which means bottom left, you still acknowledge there are small and unhealthy churches. Absolutely there are. Top right, we acknowledge there are big and healthy churches. Absolutely there are. But now we make way for the possibility that there might be some big and unhealthy churches, and there might be a whole lot of small and healthy churches. On the one-dimensional continuum, there's not even room for those two things to exist. You've got to break it out into two. You've got to see health and growth as two separate things that often combine but don't necessarily combine. And we've got to treat them separately. So when we look at this, we can start to acknowledge, okay, in this kind of a situation, what we've got here then is that the teaching and learning should not go from top to bottom. It should go from right to left. It shouldn't be going from big to small. It should be going from healthy to unhealthy. Which means, yes, there are still some things in the small church context that I can learn from my friends in big, healthy churches. Absolutely. But there is some good news. There are some big churches that are recognizing they can also learn some things from small and healthy churches. I've done some consultation at multi-site, and I've been really blessed by the fact that they acknowledge they can learn something from the small church guy. There's one church, 1,400 people. They've got 7 campuses with 2 services per campus, and their plan is to add a service every time they gain another 100 people. They want an average of 100 people in each service. So 7 campuses, 2 services per campus, 1,400 people when I consulted with them a couple years ago. And they brought me in because they said, we understand how to do the big church stuff. So Monday through Saturday, when all the pastors are together and we're coordinating stuff, we can do that. Each site has its own local pastor who's physically on the plant on the Sunday. They have their own local worship band. They have their own youth group. They have their own everything. And most people who go to those local campuses don't know they're a part of a multi-site church. It doesn't matter. So that during the week, they can resource the multi-site the resources that the multi-site has, but they have the intimacy on Sunday morning of a smaller group. They've got the best of both worlds. So he called me up and he said, we're having a hard time. We're struggling in some of our smaller campuses on Sunday and we don't know why. So I said, I'll come in, let me talk with them and see if I can figure something out for you. So I sat down, and at first I was just exploring it. Tell me about it. I've never been a part of multi-site. Tell me what's happening. And so I started with, who's in the room? Where are you? What are your campuses and what are your service sizes? And so the smallest service size was a campus where they had 40 people in the first service and 70 people in the second service. And that pastor was sitting in the room looking like lower than dirt, like he was just the biggest failure on the face of the earth. So I addressed him and said, how are you feeling about that? He says, I don't know. I've never dealt with numbers like that, and I can't seem to get them up, and I don't know what to do. Why am I failing? I said, well, first of all, you're not failing. I said, I don't like doing these comparisons, but at 110, you're bigger than 80% of the churches in the country. No, I'm not. Yeah, look it up. They're under the table Googling it while I'm talking, going, I said, but that's not the point. The point is, you want to do the small, and what is it you're having a hard time with the small? He says, I don't know. I'm not clicking. I can't. I said, describe your day. And he described his whole day, and here's a portion of what he described. He showed up, and he waited in the green room till the first service started. Then between services, he waited in the green room till the second service started. And at the end of the second service, he went back in the green room again. I said, green room, why are you going into the green room? He says, that's what I was taught. You need a green room to get away from the crowds, to get a break from the crowds. And I said, well, first of all, you don't have a crowd. I said, secondly, what size of a church were you trained in this in? It was a church of thousands. I said, in a church of thousands? Yeah, the pastor has to get away from the crowd. Because when the pastor walks through the lobby in a church of thousands, they're not pastoring the people. They're getting selfies with fans. I've seen it happen. It's not pastoring. At that size, it can't be. So yeah, they need to escape to the green room to recover and to pray and to do whatever they need to do. But I said, in your church, first thing you need to do is lock the green room door. If you need to nail it shut with plywood, do that. Do not go in your green room again. What do I do instead? You hang out in the lobby. Why? Because that's where your people are, and that's where pastoring happens. And they're all set, and they're amazed, and they're writing things down. And we can kind of laugh about it now because we know this, but they didn't know it because they hadn't been trained in the small church context to be aware of that, and they were wise enough to see what they were missing, and they called the small, healthy church guy to help them out, and they've learned from that, and they're getting better. So this is a wonderful sign that there is an opening opportunity for people to go, hey, wait a minute, small doesn't necessarily mean broken, and in fact, small has some values that we want to really work hard to have in our church as well. So some of these things are happening, and I'm grateful for that. So how do we fix this? How do we fix this? In my lifetime, we have been through three church waves. The revivalism wave happened in the 1960s and 70s. If you were to talk to a pastor in the 1960s or 70s about what their church needed, they would probably use revivalistic language. We need a revival of God's Spirit. How are you going to do that? We're going to hold prayer meetings. We're going to have revival services. We're going to have worship services. It was revivalistic language. In the 80s, 90s, and 00s, that shifted. And if you asked a pastor in the 80s, 90s, and 00s what their church was using, they would not use revivalistic language, probably. They would most likely use strategizing language. We started reading business books, like get the right people on the bus, those kinds of things, right? And in the 80s, 90s, and 00s especially, we started talking strategizing, and strategizing was what every church leadership conference was about. We're going to strategize our way to a better church. Today, starting in the teens, today in the 20s, and going in at least to the 30s, we're no longer in the strategizing era. In fact, when I talk to my friends who do church leadership conferences, I tell them, if you are starting with a baseline of talking strategy with pastors, you're behind the curve. That's yesterday's news. Today, it's not about strategizing. In the teens, the 20s, and going into the 30s, we are now in the activism era. The activism era. We see it politically. We see it theologically. We see it denominationally. It's not really, the language that people use anymore isn't so much about strategy. It's about, okay, who's in my base, how pure can we be, and how many people can we get in our base? And so it's about left against right, or it's about right against not quite so far right, or it's about left against not quite so far left, and everybody's building their own camps, and everybody's trying to get their numbers up in their own camp because it's the activism era. So We can't go back to strategizing. That's old news. I do not advise that you jump on the activism bandwagon. That's a dangerous path for a whole bunch of different reasons. So what are we going to do? Well, in the book, when I get to the last third, the last two chapters are entitled Desizing the Pastor, Desizing the Congregation, and Desizing Evangelicalism. I'll let you read that if you want to. Instead, I'm going to talk from the first two chapters where the book makes the turn towards how do we fix this. The first thing that we need to do is we need to start talking about church health non-numerically. I won't belabor this because you heard me talk about that a little bit yesterday, but we've got to change from how's your church and talking numbers to ask how's your church and start talking about stories of redemption. So we've got to start talking about church health non-numerically. But how do we start getting that? We start getting that this way. The first chapter where the book makes the turn, I'm going through this because we ran out of logbooks. Anything here I don't have with me today, sorry. So when the chapter turns, here's the first chapter where it makes the turn. Discipleship fixes everything. Bold statement, I think I can back it up. So I'm writing the book, I've got the first two-thirds done pretty much, and I've got all of the stuff I'm going to put in the last third, but I haven't really organized it yet. So I'm going through all these points that I want to make, and I look at point one and I go, what does that fall under? And I go, oh, it's kind of about discipleship. And I look at the next point and go, oh, it's kind of about discipleship. I go, man, it's like discipleship fixes everything. And I went, is that true? I think it's true. Think about it. Can you name a problem in a church that discipleship won't fix? Volunteerism, discipleship fixes that. Finances, discipleship fixes that. Disunity, discipleship fixes that. Immorality, discipleship fixes that. Bad theology, discipleship fixes that. The only problem discipleship won't fix is the size of your church, because it's not a problem to fix. But you cannot name a problem in a church that discipleship isn't the answer for. It's almost like Jesus told us to do that. I've got this picture in my head. It didn't happen in the Bible. It's only in Carl's head. But I got this picture in my head that just before Jesus ascended into heaven, he got into a huddle with his disciples and he said, okay, I'm about to ascend into heaven. I'm going to leave you behind. You're going to continue the task that I gave you. Wait in Jerusalem until you're endued with power. And then what's going to happen is this. I will build my church and you go make disciples. And the disciples respond with, got it. We'll go build your church. And he goes, No. I will build my church. You go make disciples. To which they respond, oh, got it. We'll go build your church. No! And we've been having this argument with Jesus for 2,000 years. And nowhere more obviously than during most of the church growth hype. We're going to build his church. No! Jesus has that job and he's better at it than you. He didn't tell us to build his church. He told us to make disciples. We've got to get back to discipleship because discipleship fixes everything. We lose track of that sometimes because discipleship isn't fast and discipleship isn't easy and discipleship takes time. And discipleship means having relationships with difficult people. All of those things. But discipleship is the only way forward. Discipleship fixes everything. And then the next chapter, and this will be my last point for tonight, is this. Is entitled, under discipleship, that's again another slide that we'll just not deal with for now. Integrity is the new competence. For two generations, we've been taught pastoral competence. We've been taught about technique. We've been taught about strategy. We've been taught about methods. We've been taught about new ideas. We've been taught about technology. And we've taken for granted that all the pastors in the room were people of integrity. I hate to even put this out about pastors, because I love pastors so dearly. But we all know that we can no longer assume 100% integrity in even a room full of pastors anymore. We've taught competence, technique, and strategy for 40 years, and we've left integrity in the background. We're not going to get out of the state that the American church is in today with better techniques. Our techniques are as good as they've ever been. We have a technical excellence that 20 years ago people would be stunned by. The fact that your church of 20 people can literally put video of your church live onto the internet that anybody in the world can watch while you're having your service out of a church of 20, and that you can do that with virtually no cost, would stun anybody on earth 20 years ago. Our technical stuff is as good as it's ever been. We are not going to win the world back with our technical excellence. How do I know this? Here's how. You cannot find a single person who has left the church, who has deconstructed their faith, who calls themselves an ex-evangelical or whatever terminology they use. You cannot find a single person who has walked away from their faith who says they walked away because of a lack of technical excellence in the church. Not one. I wanted to serve Jesus, but man, that the music wasn't quite up to par, so I can't serve Jesus. I wanted to serve Jesus, but that church just couldn't get their numbers up. So what was I to believe anymore? I can't serve Jesus anymore. Nobody is leaving because of a lack of technical excellence. But you'll find a whole bunch of people who are deconstructing their faith, who have left the church because of our lack of integrity. We've lost them because of our lack of integrity, and the only way we're going to gain them back is by being people of integrity again. There's no shortcut to this. I wish there was. I wish there was some technical thing. I wish there was some program I could sell you for $19.95 that would... No. We've got to make disciples who become disciple makers, and we've got to be people of our word again. All the stats have shown this recently, that trust in pastors and trust in churches is at its lowest point in all of the time they've been keeping records of this. Trust in us has dropped to record lows. The good news, if you can call it good news, is that's pretty much across the board in almost every institution. But we shouldn't be comparing ourselves to other institutions. We should be different from that. We should be the standard that was held apart from that, and we're not. But the difference is this. Let me tell you, this is especially good news for the smaller church. Here's the good news behind that gray cloud. When they ask people in general, what do you think of Christians or of pastors' lowest trustworthiness record that we've never seen? But if they ask a second question, do you know any Christians, do you know any pastors? If the answer is yes, and they ask them, do you trust the Christians you know, do you trust the pastors you know, the confidence level rises to well up to right around 70%. So the bad news is, they don't like us, but if they get to know you, they can trust you. And if they get to know the people in your church, they can trust the people in your church. We're not going to do it institutionally. We're not going to do it through advertising. We're not going to do it through big media campaigns. We are going to do it by getting to know our neighbors again, one neighbor at a time, by living a life of integrity in front of them, and by discipling them in the way of Jesus, by being an example of the way of Jesus in their life. This is slow. This is ponderous. This is not spectacular, but this is the only way forward. Integrity is the new competence. We have got to be people of integrity again. For 40 years, I have been told by my church growth friends to set a big plan and reach out for that plan to stretch your faith. And I want to propose this. Instead of setting bigger plans, we need to set a moral compass, and we need to stick with it. Thank you.